Hari Hari Bol, all glories to the symbol devotees. All glories to the symbol devotees, all glories to the symbol devotees. All glories to Shishi Guru and Gauranga. Glories to Srila Prabhupada, Mahavishnu Vishnupadaya, Krishna Prashtaya, Bhutale, Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamine. Namaste, Saraswati Devi, Gauravani Bacharni, Nivashesh Shunyavari, Pashchatchade Satarni. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So I am expecting His Holiness Bhaktivedipura Maharaj to come, but one important guest was seen approaching here a few minutes ago, so maybe he's talking with him. So I'll take just a few. Hare Krishna. I'll take a few moments just to bring us up to speed on some points. I believe yesterday, those who are full-time enrollees, you received this, did you? Yes, so this is the Notakam, or essential points of interest for enrolled students for chapters 1 through 12. This is a kind of looking back, because as you know, in putting this course together, well, we're still putting this course together, and we've been starting with a skeleton idea and playing it by ear, judging by your, you know, reciprocating with you. And we're, I think now as we approach the end of the first canto, we've kind of crystallized the actual form that this course is going to take from now on, or at least from chapter 17, the study guide to chapter 17 from now on until the end of the 12th chapter. Pretty much we've basically got it filled out in our minds what we want. And so because some of this was missing in the earlier chapters, this is a handout to fill in the blank spaces. So you get in here the, especially the, what's really important is the pratigya, or the solemn purpose of each chapter, with the verse references and relevant quotation from the purport. This is, in short, the elaboration from the chapter which explains the title that Prabhupada selected, because the titles of each chapter are Prabhupada's own. If you compare that with the original Sanskrit titles, you see Prabhupada has his own particular transcendental reasons why he's named the chapters as he does. So we try to go through the verses and purports and select those references that really elaborate in as few words as possible on the purport, on the chapter title. So that you can see why that title brings out the real essence of the chapter. We feel that's very important. So then in this way we start with an understanding of what this chapter is about. And then secondly, we go through, we have the Adhyaya Prakash, the overview, brief overview of the chapter. And then we go to the Shloka Anusharanam, which is the more detailed shloka by shloka summary. Summary study, as Prabhupada would call it. And then we have the Parishishtam, the appendix. And the appendix includes the Vinodakam again, which is specifically items of importance for enrolled students who are going to be faced with taking exams. And we've decided that the exams will go canto by canto. So, as I've been indicating, those of you who are full enrolled students are facing, before the end of this semester, an examination on Canto 1. I want to assure you that it's not going to be, you know, as I say, some kind of Frankenstein monster that we're unleashing on you. It's not going to be difficult. In fact, I can tell you basically right now, after having discussed this morning with Maharaj, that it's going to consist of 4 essay questions, 3 of which are mandatory. You will have 2 full sessions, class sessions, to answer these 4 questions, in other words, 2 hours. So if all you can do is answer the 3 mandatory questions, that means you get 45 minutes to answer each essay question, which I think is fair, because the essay questions are not going to be tricky. They're going to be pretty straightforward. And if you can do it in half an hour, then you'll be able to answer the extra essay question, which will be for extra points. And the way we're going to do it is that the minimum passing grade is 60%. You have to get a 60% score, then you've passed. So if, for example, okay, let's go over what we said, 3 mandatory questions. So that means you're going to get a question of a, you know, from the pratigya category. That means you're going to get a statement, which is the essential purpose of a chapter. You're going to be expected to know from that essential statement what the chapter is. And you're going to have to then give a little elaboration on why this is the essence of the chapter. You're going to be asked, you're going to be given a question and an answer from one of the 19 chapters of the first canto. You're going to have to tell us what chapter this comes from. And you're going to be asked some basic questions about the meaning of the question, the answer, why it's important. And then there are the important verses. You get this on the graph handout. The important verses. So you'll be, you know, as we described, reaching into a pot, 3 pots. Maharaj says this is the Vedic system. I have no idea if this is the Vedic system, but this is what he says. 3 clay pots laid in front of you. So from the verse pot, you'll select and you'll get a verse. So, if you can explain philosophically what the verse is about, you'll get 70% credit right there. That means you'll pass just explaining what this verse is about. If you can tell us what chapter the verse comes from, you get another 10% on top of that. If you can tell us the number of the verse, you get another 10% on top of that. If you can tell us who spoke this verse to who, then you get 100% credit. And if you can tell us the Sanskrit of the verse, you get 120% credit. You see, isn't that? We're being very liberal. But for the first canto. Because you see, this is all kind of, you know, gelling, coming together, experimental. We plan canto by canto that these examinations will become more rigorous, you know, less forgiving, but we're being very forgiving. And then, besides these 3 mandatory questions, then if you have the time, if you can do those within half an hour, then you'll have a last half hour where you can write on a lila from the first canto that you particularly like, and you can write your realizations, and that's all extra credit. That's all, you know, plus. So even if you screw up somewhere else, you can still, you know, as they say, save the ball, you know, comparing it to some ball game. Footy, is that what they call it now? Football. Or basketball or something. And still save the ball, make the basket on extra credit. So we feel this is very fair. what you can bring to the class. You can bring a plain BBT volume of the first canto. You cannot bring any of our handout materials. You cannot bring your own notes, because what's important is that you should know the book. So you can bring one plain edition, BBT edition of the book without any, we're going to check that, no notes in the margin, no little slips of paper stuck in. And at the end of the first session, you have to hand in your paper. We'll keep it overnight. That means you can go home and study your brains out, you know. Now, you'll know all the questions after the first session, so you can study, you can, you know. But you'll have to come back the next day only with your memory, you see. No cheat sheets, crib sheets, or anything like that. No Barrett's notes of the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know. Cliff's notes, or what are they called? Cliff's notes of the Srimad Bhagavatam. You just have to come with your memory. But you have the book. So that's what's important for us, that you know the book. If you've learned what's in Prabhupada's books, we have no problem with that, that you refer to the original text. And we think that's great. You see, we think that's wonderful. That you'll be able to answer the questions just referring to Srila Prabhupada's original text. So that'll be the condition. Bring the book, but don't bring anything else. And you even get one night, because it'll be an exam that cover two. Like we'll try to arrange it so it'll be on Thursday and Friday. So it means Thursday night you can go back. You'll know the questions. You can study. I was raised in the piranha fish school of examinations, the schools I went to, the teachers were really, but you're so liberal. Well, you're so lucky to have Maharaj. I would have never thought of that. I would have thought of something very diabolical. He's always keeping me in check. So, you know. Okay, John. We even give them the questions on Tuesday. Wow.
But like you say, they come without notes from the book. Because the point is Prabhupada's books is what you're going to work with. You're not going to be traveling around or this. You go to a temple, they don't have all your notes. They only have a Bhagavatam. So you have to be able to speak from the Bhagavatam, right? That's the point. You're a preacher, you speak from Prabhupada's books. So the idea is, the course is to know Prabhupada's books. You know, so therefore it's not a trick, this, that, or it's know the books, work with the books, you know where to find things in the books, because so many points are side points. Yeah. You know, you read a point and you know it's about this lila, like there's something about Hiranyakashipu and all that lila, but it's not in the seventh canto, it's somewhere else. It's in a different canto, and then you can never find it. So that's the whole thing. Know the book. You can speak from the book. You can sit down and give a class. You can give seminars. You have the book. Because what we teach is just the foundation as a springboard from there to further realizations and help others. That's the point. In other words, you're being trained how to yourself study and practice and how to teach. Does that make sense?
We're trying to give an organized template that you put over the book so you know where things are. That's why we have in the last part, the last thing we have to add to our study guide is that we're going to give titles to these. That's going to come, I think, in chapter 17. To these quotations from the purports, we'll give titles to them. Because there's always these purports, you know. You read and you know that there's something interesting in you, but you forget where the purport was. And you say, I read in one purport this very interesting thing. And you tell another devotee, but you can never remember where that purport is. So we're trying to solve that problem by, you know, finding all the interesting details in the purports and labeling them and making sure that they clearly stand out in your mind. So, anyway, all I can say is, there's one drawback to Maharaj's liberality, that if you fail the exam, You're going to suffer from intense low self-esteem, and it's going to be well-deserved.
Yeah, we could set up a board in the back. It's like a board, and then they got a thing with a shoe on it, and then you can step on it and kick yourself.
Oh. No, you're not a Loron. You're a
droid. I don't have an exam.
Moron indicates that there is a brain, but you don't use it. You're looking at it. Now, one thing, because Maharaj explained very nicely about the first three. On the fourth one, on the Leela, that doesn't mean just recapping the Leela. That means telling the aspect of the Leela and its practical application that you found impressed you for use in your life or in others. It's not to just tell the Leela. We're talking about what in the Leela became practical for you that you can, you know, in other words, it's a matter of like your personal realization that you've gleaned from seeing the pastimes of the Lord and his devotees. That's what's being looked for.
It's like your personal favorite Leela because you got the most out of it.
So that's why it gets weight, because it's realization, you know, understanding, realization.
So I wasn't here, you Maharaj, so I think you should
start.
Start.
Okay.
I will follow you.
Okay, we got to page 4. One thing I was thinking is maybe between these sections, just put some asterisks, because sometimes because of the nimesha, sometimes you're not sure where the one group is end and the next one started.
The
number.
In bold.
Yeah. No, that's there. But sometimes it's just you're not sure if this is going back and it's continuing or if it's the end. Just like that. It's just my bewilderment here. Okay. Then on the bottom. O King, as for the male residents of Dwarka, I must inform you that they were cursed by the Brahmanas, and as a result, they became mad with intoxication by drinking rice wine. A fight broke out amongst themselves with deadly results. Now only 4 or 5 of the Yadus remain alive. I know that this is all due to the will of the Supreme Lord. Just as bigger aquatics swallow the smaller ones, so the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to lighten the burden of the earth, engaged the stronger Yadus in killing the weaker ones. My dear brother, now my only wish is to take shelter of those instructions that Lord Krishna personally imparted to me. For I know that they are the only means to get relief from the flaming emotions that consume my troubled heart. 22 to 27, Nimesha. In 27th purport, Srila Prabhupada makes clear that by those instructions, Arjuna means Bhagavad Gita, spoken by Lord Krishna at the start of the Kurukshetra War. The following section, that's interesting, to get rid of separation, one turns to the Bhagavad Gita.
Big point of this chapter.
The following section of 27th purport is most illuminating for students of the two greatest works of Bhagavat literature. His Divine Grace expertly summarizes the Gita and leaves no doubt that it teaches in concise form the same knowledge as Srimad Bhagavatam. Oh, so this is one of those classic purports. In the Bhagavad Gita, 5 important factors of knowledge have been delineated pertaining to 1, the Supreme Lord, 2, the living being, 3, nature, 4, time and space, and 5, the process of activity. Out of these, the Supreme Lord and the living being are qualitatively one. The difference between the two has been analyzed as the difference between the whole and the part and parcel. Nature is inert matter displaying the interaction of 3 different modes, and eternal time and limited space are considered to be beyond the existence of the material nature. Activities of the living being are different varieties of aptitudes, which can entrap or liberate the living being within and without material nature. All these subject matters are concisely discussed in the Bhagavad Gita. And later, the subject matters are elaborated in the Srimad Bhagavatam for further enlightenment. Out of the 5 subjects, the Supreme Lord, the living entity, nature, and time and space are eternal. But the living entity, nature, and time are under the direction of the Supreme Lord,
who is absolute and completely independent of any other control. The Supreme Lord is the Supreme Controller. The material activity of the living being is beginningless, but it can be rectified by transferal into the spiritual quality. Thus, so rectified means brought back to normal. You know, in other words, the word rectified means there's a time when they weren't materially contaminated. Does that make sense? So if you want to hair split words like anadi, then here's a word for you. Okay. Thus it can cease its material qualitative reactions. Both the Lord and the living entity are cognizant, and both have the sense of identification, of being conscious as a living force. But the living being, under the condition of material nature, called Mahat-Tattva, misidentifies himself as being different from the Lord. The whole scheme of Vedic wisdom is targeted to the aim of eradicating such a misconception, and thus liberating the living being from the illusion of material identification. When such an illusion is eradicated by knowledge and renunciation, the living beings are responsible actors and enjoyers also. The sense of enjoyment in the Lord is real, but such a sense in the living being is a sort of wishful desire only. This difference in consciousness is the distinction of the two entities, two identities, namely the Lord and the living being. Otherwise, there is no difference between the Lord and the living being. The living being is therefore eternally one and different simultaneously. The whole instruction of the Bhagavad Gita stands on this principle. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord and the living beings are both described as sanatana, or eternal. And the Lord's abode, far beyond the material sky, is also described as sanatana. The living being is invited to live in the sanatana existence of the Lord. And the process which can help a living being to approach the Lord's abode, where the liberated activity of the soul is exhibited, is called sanatana dharma. One cannot, however, reach the eternal abode of the Lord without being free from the misconception of material identification. And the Bhagavad Gita gives us the clue how to achieve this stage of perfection. The process of being liberated from the misconception of material identification is called, in different stages, fruit of activity, empiric philosophy, and devotional service, up to transcendental realization. Such transcendental realization is made possible by dovetailing all the above items in relation with the Lord. Prescribed duties of the human being, as directed in the Vedas, can gradually purify the sinful mind of the conditioned soul and raise him to the stage of knowledge. The purified stage of acquiring knowledge becomes the basis of devotional service to the Lord. As long as one is engaged in researching the solution of the problems of life, his knowledge is called jnana, or purified knowledge. But on realizing the actual solution of life, one becomes situated in the devotional service of the Lord. The Bhagavad Gita begins with the problems of life by discriminating the soul from the elements of matter and proves by all reason and argument that the soul is indestructible in all circumstances and that the outer covering of matter, the body and the mind, change for another term of material existence which is full of miseries. The Bhagavad Gita is therefore meant for terminating all different types of miseries, and Arjuna took shelter of this great knowledge which had been imparted to him during the Kurukshetra battle. That's the end of... That's in the connection with that section, no?
Well, 22-27. We'll more from this purport a little later. We'll get into deeper things.
Deeper things, yeah. How do you say? In other words, those five aspects, that is knowledge, because Bhagavad Gita is the ABCs. So when Prabhupada says these five things, that is the field of philosophical knowledge. The Supreme Lord, the living being, nature, time and space, and the process of activity. Right? He's mentioned the first four eternal, and the second, third, and fourth are under the Supreme Lord. The fifth, the process of activity, that's karma, that's temporary. Means it's always going on in the material world, but for the individual living entity, it's a temporary thing. But everything else is...
That's nice how Prabhupada He gives an elaboration. He says the difference between the two, that means Supreme Lord and Living Being, has been analyzed as the difference between the whole and the part and parcel. Nature is inert matter displaying the interaction of the three different modes, and eternal time and unlimited space are considered to be beyond the existence of the material nature. Mm-hmm. Activities of the living being are different varieties of aptitudes which can entrap or liberate the living being within and without material nature. So activities, karma, has a double meaning. Yeah. It can be material karma or it can be naish karma, bhakti yoga. And then Prabhupada concludes by saying all these subject matters are concisely discussed in the Bhagavad Gita, and later the subject matters, seems the same five, are elaborated in the Srimad Bhagavatam for further enlightenment. So, in other words, Bhagavatam is the same, consisting of the same five subject matters.
Because these are all your Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Like that. So it all fits into there. And so this is a very nice way of explaining. I think the introduction to Gita then probably brings this out very much. It's like the main point.
Maharaj, maybe a quick comment, because in our talks you've been saying how Bhakti Shastri course, when we start to have it, that's the course of, involved discussion or, if necessary, even back and forth argumentation of points, but this class is not. And then we hear, where is it, just at the end,
the Bhagavad Gita is therefore meant for terminating all different types of miseries, that one, or?
No, where he says all reason and argument. Where is that? Yes, here it is. The Bhagavad Gita is right almost in the middle on page 6. The Bhagavad Gita begins with the problems of life by discriminating the soul from the elements of matter and proves by all reason and argument that the soul is indestructible in all circumstances, and that the outer covering of matter, the body and the mind, change for another term of material existence, which is full of miseries. This seems to me to be a pretty good reference to, the boundaries in which discussion, you can have discussion, say, within Bhakti Shastri. Mm-hmm. Like Srila Prabhupada seems to be laying it out.
Yeah.
Because he says all reason and argument. So
all reason and argument and solving the problems of life.
Yeah.
So those things where the emotional difficulties, this thing, how to interact, what to do, deal, that's actually the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavatam is then for refined development of one's own personal and others' devotional life, the attitude. But basically, the
that means one, by the Bhagavatam stage, should have come to some realized platform where these issues are no longer clouding one's mind.
In other words, it shouldn't be, in the Bhagavatam, you should not be dealing with any doubts or misgivings concerning the validity or efficacy of the Vedic literature. There should be nothing that, Bhagavatam doesn't quite know, or it's not exactly like that, or it doesn't actually apply, or that's all for Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavatam is for those who have accepted that the Bhagavatam gives all the answers. It gives everything. You can perfect your life through that, and you can help anybody in any situation with it. And it's just a matter of understanding its broadness and its application. That you're understanding how to apply it in so many situations and how it functions. Does that make some sense? That's what the Bhagavatam is. In other words, because it's already starting, the second verse says we're already kicking out everything else. We're only for those who want to taste the nectar. This is the process. But if you have a doubt whether there is nectar or whether it's worth endeavoring for or this and that, that's Bhagavad Gita.
like that. And we see is the difference here is Arjuna is then free from all doubts in the last, you know, 5 or 6 verses of the Gita. So that means the first 695 verses are there for discussion and for removing all that. But the Bhagavatam in the second verse is already starting that we're not dealing with anything outside of the desire for perfecting pure, unalloyed devotional service. Does that make some sense? So there's a difference. That's why sometimes you see in here is if a question comes up, we will refer it, unless it's, you know, felt to be important. But otherwise, it will be referred to, this will go back to the Bhakti Shastri. That's the forum for more question answers, interacting, trying to remove the doubts, going back to, you know, your mother eating too many pretzels and, you know, all these different things, therefore you're all screwed up, you know, and all these things. That's Bhagavad Gita. You know, but Bhagavatam is how to taste, how to practically taste the nectar of transcendence and how to practice it, how to give it to others. That's the Bhagavatam.
May I continue? The rest of the 15th chapter is a commentary by Sudha Goswami on Arjuna's reply to Maharaj Yudhisthira and the effect that reply had upon the Pandavas. First, he tells the sages that Arjuna, deeply absorbed in thinking of the instructions the Lord imparted at Kurukshetra, became pacified at heart as all material contamination vanished from his consciousness. Arjuna's spiritual assets as an associate of the Lord, which had apparently been covered by his doubts and lamentation, were fully restored. As his eternal identity asserted itself, Arjuna was released from the fetters. Fetters means the chains of the modes of material nature. So that's a summary of 28 through 31. Now, I would make a comment on this, but actually, in the Vinodikam, we go much further into this. So therefore, I'm going to save my comment, but except to say that it's clear here, it's wonderfully clear here, that the Srimad Bhagavatam, Sutta Goswami, in this portion of the Srimad Bhagavatam, is actually glorifying the Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many of us have appreciated this revelation in this chapter of the Bhagavatam, of the deep relationship that's being shown here between these two great Bhagavata texts, that the Sutta Goswami is in effect here glorifying the Bhagavad Gita as Arjuna's means of becoming spiritually restored. And when we get to the Vinodikam and quote from Prabhupada's purport, it's going to become crystal clear. So actually, these two works, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, they're inseparable in a sense. Mm-hmm. They're meant to be studied together. Bhagavad Gita has a particular purpose in relationship to Srimad Bhagavatam, which is very wonderful.
Because but if you have an association, like something is means you consider it a close association and you really feel inspired by it when everyone is like-minded. You know, so you can say something and you don't have to worry that the other one will take it this way or that way or if it's politically correct, or you know that whatever you say, everyone in the group understands and appreciates. And then everybody else will just take that and build on that. And so it just becomes a very nice interaction. Well, when you have many different kinds of mentalities, then it becomes more formal and you have to be very careful on this and that. Does that make sense? So the Bhagavatam means everybody's on the same page. Gita is there for everybody may not be, so this is where you work it out. And you come to the same. But then you have that nice association. Because otherwise, you can't go deeply into a relationship if there's always doubt and argument, and no but, and this, and it just doesn't work. Unless everybody in the group likes to do that, of course. But it's a matter of, that's the difference between the two.
Yeah.
Scriptures.
I'd like to add something, though. Not to subtract it from anything Maharaj said, but there's another side to it. The fact that the Gita is condensed, because it is, in a sense, the ABC, but in another sense, it's the same thing that's presented in the Bhagavatam, but condensed. So therefore, it has a very exalted function, which we will see in the Vinodikam, in terms of the highest reaches of Bhagavad Dharma, which is glorified in the Srimad Bhagavatam. You can actually come back to the Gita after having explored the Bhagavatam philosophy in full and what the whole point of everything is, learn that from Bhagavatam. Then you come back to the Gita and see the Gita in a completely new light. The Gita is not simply just ABCs and just clearing away doubts. But here I'll give a little hint. But it's actually the essence of associating with Krishna, because of the words of Krishna. But I don't want to say more because it's going to come out shortly.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned. So, continuing. Sutta then points out that as soon as he heard about Lord Krishna's disappearance and the annihilation of the Yadu dynasty, Maharaj Yudhisthira decided to go back home, back to Godhead. Arjuna's words had been overheard by Queen Kunti. They instilled in her the same determination. She instantly applied her full attention to the devotional service of the Lord. From the very day that Lord Krishna departed from the earth, the personality of Kali, who had already partially appeared, became fully manifest. At once, innumerable inauspicious conditions were created. Being intelligent enough to perceive this, Yudhisthira first of all enthroned his grandson, Parikshit, as the emperor of the world. Then he posted Aniruddha's son, Vajra, at Mathura, to rule the kingdom of Shurasena. Now free from governmental responsibility, Maharaj Yudhisthira performed a Prajapatya sacrifice in preparation for accepting the renounced order of life. I take that would be Vanaprastha.
Because they go with the wife. So, but it's interesting that he did something to just kind of like create that sense of, what do you call it? Rites of passage, Because there's not a specific ritual for Vanaprastha, but it's something you would just do something to, that in your mind you feel something special is going on. Mm-hmm.
So that's a summary of verses 32-39. And then, continuing, after ridding himself of his royal robes and ornaments, Yudhisthira donned torn cloth. He gave up eating all solid food. He let his hair hang down loose and voluntarily became dumb. Thus assuming the appearance of a madman, Yudhisthira showed no interest in anything, even his brothers. He acted as if he heard nothing around him, just like a deaf man. Completely giving up the bodily conception of life, Yudhisthira departed at once for the north to absorb himself fully in thought of the Supreme Lord. 40-44. So, Yudhisthira took, in one sense, Vanaprastha, but also there's definitely an avaduta quality to his Vanaprastha. So,
because they're
extreme
supposed to
renunciation.
The idea in the minor process, they become, basically they're trying to get the point of indifference to everything that the senses interact with. You don't care about hearing things, you don't care if it rains, if the sun's out, if there's wind, if it's hot, it's cold, you just don't care. That's kind of like that you're moving towards, but you take it, stage by stage as you can handle it, but here we see Yudhisthira Maharaj, because it's so perfect, then, it's just a matter of changing clothes and taking on that mentality that others would take, you know, 12 years or more to perfect. You know.
So in a sense, he was even more austere than a sannyasi. Sannyasi has a mission, and therefore he has to also, you know, pay attention to external conditions to fulfill his mission. But Yudhisthira was completely...
What's interesting is that in Manu, austerity, because generally we take austerity meaning, you know, just the as exclusively meaning, you know, like standing on your toes out, you know, in the sun for 200 years and not only breathing air and stuff like that. But austerity specifically means performance of your prescribed duties. So it says that for a Brahmin to study the scriptures is considered the greatest austerities. It says even up to the ends of his nails. It means that's the, as you know, you can't get farther than that, you know. So it's that, it's the greatest austerity. So he says even if he's sitting there wearing a garland in a very comfortable situation, if he's actually studying the scriptures, then that's the most greatest austerity that a Brahmin could be performing. Or for a king, the greatest austerity is protecting his people. Or for the Vaishya, it's to create economic development and then give it away in charity. And for the Shudras, to assist, you know, like that. So every position has its austerity. So like you're saying, the austerity of the Vanaprastha would be, you could say, is actually more if we take the that first definition of just being physically corrosive to the senses. The Vanaprastha is actually more austere than the sannyas, because that is his austerity, is being ignoring the senses and actually doing things that are not great for the senses. Well, the sannyas has a mission, so therefore he takes and consider the situation so that he can perform that. Well, his mission is to deliver the knowledge and realization. The Vanaprastha is to control the senses and that. And if somebody comes to him, then he speaks. Well, the sannyasi has to go out to speak.
Okay. So then, Ramesha inserted a comment in 42 purport. Srila Prabhupada describes the meditational technique that Maharaj Yudhisthira employed. This is very interesting. When we were giving in the afternoon Bhagavad Science of the Mind, this came up. We talked about this. So all that is manifest in the material world is a product, Prabhupada writes, of the Mahatattva Avyakta. This is actually in reference to the Pradhana. So you can understand from this that there are two phases of Mahatattva. The Vyakta, which is when Garbhadakshayi Vishnu, the Hiranyagarbha manifestation, and then you have the Shodshakala, the 16 constituents, the mind as the center, then five karmendriyas, five gyanendriyas, and five sense perceptions. They're manifested in philosophy, you'd say, like the Platonic ideal, because they're manifested by the Lord. And Lord Brahma refers to that in his creation, in assigning senses to the different living entities according to their karma. He's referring to that ideal manifestation of the original 16 constituents of creation as manifested by Hiranyagarbha or Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. So that's the Vyakta, or manifest Mahatattva. But the Avyakta Mahatattva, that's the Mahavishnu level. As Prabhupada says, Mahavishnu is lying in a cloud, which is called the Mahatattva, but the cloud...
That's also
Mahatattva, but it's just a cloud. It's just, there's no... And actually in 12th canto... No, yeah, 12th canto, Shukadeva Goswami explains the experience of that. He says, which is interesting, he said to experience that pradhan or unmanifested Mahatattva is to experience shunya, the void, which is the goal of the Buddhists. Mm-hmm. In other words, they just, like Prabhupada says, they just break down material elements beyond all manifestation. There's just they're not assembled in any way, and then there's nothing to perceive anymore. And then they think that's the end.
So it's kind of like, means that one sense you could say is that of the you know, the voidism, the impersonalism, and then the, you know, hedonism, whatever, is that the living entity is when Mahavishnu breathes in, then everything stops completely, and there's not even any awareness. So that's the living entity is kind of in the state of voidism.
Yeah.
The experience would be, though he's not. Then in the second Mahatattva, when the Lord glances over the Pradhan, and then the jivas go in with eternal time and all of their desires, then it becomes like alive. Then that would be like they're, in one sense, merged. You know, they're in the Brahman platform. It's Vasudeva Sattva is Brahman. So they're on the Brahman platform. But they don't have any specific material needs. They think I'm God. Yeah. So the consciousness is polluted, but it's not manifest. Then when Brahma manifests, then it comes down to then the activities that we know. So living entity that mean in every creation gets all the three experiences.
So Maharaj Yudhisthira, then he wound up his consciousness into this Mahatattva Avyakta. So Prabhupada goes on to say, things that are visible in our material vision are nothing but, this is where you realize that things that are visible in our material vision are nothing but combinations and permutations of such variegated material products. But the living entity is different from such material products. It is due to the living entity's forgetfulness of his eternal nature as eternal servitor of the Lord, and his false conception of being a so-called Lord of the material nature, that he is obliged to enter into the existence of false sense enjoyment. Thus a concomitant generation of material energies is the principal cause of the mind's being materially affected. Thus the gross body of five elements is produced. Maharaj Yudhisthira reversed the action and merged the five elements of the body into the three modes of material nature. The qualitative distinction of the body as being good, bad, or mediocre is extinguished, and again the qualitative manifestations become merged in the material energy, which is produced from a false sense of the pure living being, in other words, from the false ego, which is the province of Sankarshan or Mahavishnu. That's what he specifically governs. When one is thus inclined to become an associate of the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead, and one of the innumerable planets of the spiritual sky, especially in Goloka Vrindavan, one has to think always that he is different from the material energy. He has nothing to do with it. And he has to realize himself as pure spirit, Brahman, qualitatively equal with the Supreme Brahman Parameshwar. Maharaj Yudhisthira, after distributing his kingdom to Parikshit and Vajra, did not think himself emperor of the world or head of the Kuru dynasty. The sense of freedom from material relations as freedom from the material, as well as freedom from the material engagement of the gross and subtle encirclement, Prabhupada's language is beautiful, makes one free to act as the servitor of the Lord, even though one is in the material world. This stage is called the Jivan Mukta stage, or the liberated stage, even in the material world. That is the process of ending material existence. One must not only think that he is Brahman, but must act like Brahman. One who only thinks himself Brahman is an impersonalist, and one who acts like Brahman is the pure devotee. That's a great purport.
That's also very, very simple. Distinction where we say also we accept the principle of Brahman. Yeah. And we're all Brahman, but it's one is acting like Brahman and one is just thinking. That's really good. So the Abhideya actually makes a difference. I mean, so also it's like Krishna's Atmarama, and then manifesting the you know, the cause of creation is Abhideya, is the interaction. So then between just being Brahman or being actually situated as a devotee, then it's just whether you're active as Brahman or you're inactive.
So in the few, we have a few minutes left, I'd like to just say one more pertaining to the conduct of the class, is that now we are in chapter 15, which is related to chapter 16, because there's a question asked in chapter 15 which will be answered in chapter 16.
It's 14.
Chapter 15 is answering the question of chapter 14, and also chapter 16 will ask a question that will be answered in chapter 17. So these two chapters are related in that way. So now David Prabhu is working on a play with the boys that will be performed next week on chapter 14. 13. Okay. 13. Let's get this right. And we'd like to ask Shanti Parayan Prabhu to, over the weekend, start to organize something for chapters 14 and 15. Because these two go together. Chapter 14 is when the question was posed by Maharaj Yudhisthira, what happened at Dwarka. And chapter 15 is when Arjuna answers it. So with some of our students, we can have a presentation on that. And then other students, we can have a presentation on the next two chapters, which are similarly related. A question is asked in one in chapter 16 and answered in chapter 17. So our student body can be divided into two. You got that? Apart from the boys are going to be dealing with chapter 13. They're 13. So for the adults, we have 14 and 15 and 16 and 17. So
I would have to find out which two, 14 and 15.
Yeah. So we have to deal with that first. We haven't even, then we have to go through 16 and 17 yet. But then those who weren't involved in what you do with 14 and 15. Then they should be involved in 16 and 17. Thanks, Lord. I was never very good with arithmetic. Yes, I should. That's okay.
If there's anybody who's got any
The idea is that you know something's coming, so you can prepare for it. You see something's coming, they get ideas and discuss it, so it's not just sudden. That way then it just different groups just keep leapfrogging.
Main thing is that 13, the 14 and 15 are now on the table. So that's like something has to get into works on those two chapters. And then you have to decide who will be involved in that, and then who can just wait and take the next two, be involved in the presentation of the next two. Okay. So that'll be next week. Next week will be largely taken up with class reciprocation. He thinks that the drama of the boys will be later in the week, like maybe Thursday. He's got to finish the script and, of course, do some practice. But I'm sure it will be spellbinding, as it always has been in the past. If there's one thing these boys are good for, it's acting. I mean, they're always acting here. Like, for example, they're always acting like they're good students. So they're very skilled at acting. They're always acting like they're good little boys. Wouldn't we know better?
Yeah, or they walk around the corner and go up the stairs.
Great actors. We want to have a drama and film department here in our school. We've got so much talent coming through here. Shouldn't be wasted.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktavrinda ki, Jayanita Gaurav.